Southern African Development Community, SADC, has deployed troops in member state Mozambique to combat terrorism. These regional troops have been successful in drastically reducing terrorist attacks in the country's Cabo Delgado province. Speaking during a SADC summit, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said the regional economic bloc cannot allow terrorism to thrive in member states.
We are cognizant of the magnitude of ground that still needs to be covered in the work that we have to do. Therefore, we cannot let our guard down. Terrorism cannot be permitted to continue to thrive in any part of our region.
Our last question to you, Mr. Freeman. Now, we have seen a relatively successful story of combating terrorism in Mozambique through collaboration among regional countries. Now, can these be replicated elsewhere in Africa, especially in West Africa?
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to admit, I'm not completely familiar with the programs itself, but it has to be replicated on the rest of the African continent. Africa needs unity, and it needs a unity that that does not rely, depend on, or take directions from the Western countries like the U.S. or any place in Western Europe. And I consider the U.S. as an extension of Europe. It's a settler colony. It's an extension of Europe. And this agenda is the continuation of colonialism. It's what we call neocolonialism. So the only way forward, no country in the continent of Africa, and this was already laid out perfectly by Kwame Nkrumah in a number of books, particularly his book called The Challenge of the Congo, where he talks about, in that book, talking about how no individual African state can expect to succeed and go things alone without collaboration, full collaboration and a strategic program with the other surrounding countries within the African continent. It is an imperative that countries in Africa replicate cooperation, but also cooperation that is not rejects the designs and the interests of the Western countries.
Well, we'd like to thank Mr. Freeman for his analysis, and as he said, intra-Africa collaboration devoid of meddling by Western powers is critical in solving the security challenges facing the continent. We now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the latest developments in Mali.
Conspiring against Mali.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Mali's government says it recently thwarted an attempted coup led by army officers and supported by an unnamed Western state.
In a statement, Mali's government spokesperson, Colonel Abdoulaye Maiga, said a small group of anti-progressive Malian officers and non-commissioned officers attempted a coup in the night of May 11 to 12, 2022. The attempted coup came amid rising tension between Mali and its former colonial power, France. Mali has revoked a military agreement with France while boosting defense cooperation with Russia.
Now, all these decisions have not gone down well with the authorities in Paris. The row between the two countries further escalated after the military-led government in Mali blamed France for violating the country's airspace.
Gouvernement de la République du Mali Since the beginning of the year, the government of the Republic of Mali has noted more than 50 deliberate cases of violation of Malian airspace by foreign aircraft, particularly those operated by French forces.
Now, for more on frequent reports that France is conspiring against the government in Mali, we contacted Mostafa Traoré, a Malian academic and political analyst and the founder of AnOpenEye.org. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Now, our first question to you, is France conspiring against the government of Mali?
The thing is that there's a correlation between the presence of the French army in some zones, in some regions, and attacks. Whenever you have the French army flying a zone, a few days after, what people have noticed is that you have terrorists coming and attacking. So regarding this very specific case, it is very surprising that the French are not saying, they are not asking questions about who killed these people, because they know that if we check, if we do some medical checking, what is going to be revealed is that these people were assassinated a long time ago.
Mali's media regulator has ordered a definitive suspension of major French government-owned media outlets, France 24 Television and RFI Radio. Were these French media organizations working behind the scene against Mali's government?
Because there is a close link between these two media and the French government. They are, in fact, state media. They are sponsored, the subsidies they get are from the French government. They are, so it is as if you had the French army and all the reports, all the things they were saying about Mali was not in favor of the Malian army. When there is success achieved by the Malian army, then you have nothing written on it. But each time you have people dying, or a mistake done, you have, they try to, and also there is a problem of disinformation.
A French mission began in Mali in 2013 to allegedly counter militants that Paris claims are linked to the Al-Qaeda and Daesh terrorist groups. The war caused several thousand deaths and more than a million people to flee their homes. There have been two military coups in roughly a year amid growing demonstrations against France's military presence. Early May, Mali announced that it is cutting off its military cooperation with the French government, condemning flagrant violations of its national sovereignty by the French forces. Government spokesman Colonel Abdoulaye Maïga made the announcement on national TV.
For some time now, the government of the Republic of Mali notes with regret a profound deterioration in military cooperation with France. The government of the Republic of Mali has decided to denounce the Defense Cooperation Treaty of July 16, 2014.
The French Army's chief of staff described this decision as illegitimate. France is now seen as imposing itself on Mali.
France is trying to impose itself on Mali, but today we have to admit that France does not have the strength to do so anymore. So that's the big change. Things have changed, and the time when France could impose its decisions on the Malian people, on the nation, is finished. This time is over.
The move to end military cooperation between France and Mali was greeted with jubilation in Bamako.
France must leave Mali. France is here to steal the resources of Mali. France is here to colonize Mali. Leave the country without delay. They have been here for 10 years and could not solve the problem.
In our tradition, if there is a broom, it means we don't want any more. We don't want any more. The broom means that. That's why we put a stop to France.
Now, can you elaborate on the factors or reasons behind Mali's decision to end its military cooperation with France?
They have all the arguments. The Malians, they put on the table all the arguments they have just to justify, okay, this happened. So there was violation of the agreement by the French first when they decided to leave the country without noticing the Malian government or without speaking with the Malian government about it. So it was in the media that the Malians learned about the fact that the French had decided to leave the country.
Now, curiously, after the decision by Mali to end its military pact with France, there has been an increase in terrorist attacks in these West African countries. Now, Mr. Traoré, are these attacks instigated by external factors to pressurize the authorities in Bamako to let French-led West African forces continue their presence in these mineral-rich West African states?
The terrorists, they had equipment. They had guns, machine guns, that are French ones, that were provided by the French. And this is why, in fact, the Mali has doubts now concerning the French army. And this is why they're asking them to leave. Because how come the French admitted it? They said, okay, they gave some of the weapons or some of the equipment they gave to this organization, Le Ménéla, and did in the hands of the terrorists. How can you explain this one? You give weapons. You do not give weapons to the Malian army. You give it to a separatist group. And then we see that the weapons, they end in the hands of the terrorists. And this is, in fact, why France cannot say anything at the UN, because we have all, the Malians have all documents. It's all documented.
Togo's president, Farna Singbe, has agreed to act as a mediator between Mali and Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS. In March, ECOWAS demanded the organization of elections in Mali within 12 to 16 months.
But Mali's ruling junta rejected the demand and launched a two-year transition process before elections are held. Now, let's see what Mr. Traoré says on these mediation efforts and if there are chances of success.
What I understand is that Togolese president is in good terms with the Malian authorities. Togo is the only country trying to listen and understand the Malians. So this is one fact. The president of Mali, Assimi Goïta, he decided to go and ask the Togolese to try to work as a mediator between the ECOWAS and Mali, because none of all these other countries, part of ECOWAS, are willing to listen to what the Malians are saying. Malians are very simple. They say security first, total recovery of the country in terms of borders, and then elections.
Well, thanks as always to our guest Mustafa Traoré for his great insight on the situation in Mali. We shall keep our eyes focused on Mali and give you analysis of the situation as it unfolds. Well, and that brings us to the end of this edition of Africa Today. Thanks a lot and goodbye for now.
Are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Strong climate action could wipe $756 billion from individuals' pension funds and other investments in rich countries. We are prepared for you an article written by Damien Carrington. The piece is titled "Study Shows People in US and UK Face Huge Financial Hit If Fossil Fuels Lose Value." A new study has shown individuals in rich countries face huge financial losses if climate action slashes the value of fossil fuel assets, despite many oil and gas fields being in other countries. The researchers estimated that existing oil and gas projects worth $1.4 trillion would lose their value if the world moved decisively to cut carbon emissions and limit global heating to 2 degrees Celsius. By tracking many thousands of projects through 1.8 million companies to their ultimate owners, the team found most of the losses would be borne by individual people through their pensions, investment funds, and shareholdings. The analysis also found that financial institutions have $681 billion of these potentially worthless assets on their balance sheets, more than the estimated $250 to $500 billion of mispriced subprime housing assets that triggered the 2007-2008 financial crisis. The researchers did not predict if or when these fossil fuel stranded assets would cause a financial crash, but said the size of the number was worrying. The United States and Britain are by far the countries with the biggest potential stranded assets in their financial sectors. Overall, the study calculated that individuals own 54% of the $1.4 trillion of oil and gas assets at risk, that is, $756 billion. Three-quarters of these people are in the 38 developed countries in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD group. Governments and corporate creditors carry the balance. But the proportion is much higher in the United States and Britain, where individuals own 86% and 75% of the potentially stranded assets respectively. In contrast, 80% of those assets in China are owned by the Chinese government. Dr. Gregor Semenyuk at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst in the United States, who led the research, said, "It is pretty obvious now that the fossil fuel companies are doing things that are not compatible with mitigating climate change." The Guardian recently revealed that the oil and gas companies are planning scores of vast carbon bomb projects that would shatter internationally agreed climate targets. Dr. Gregor Semenyuk said, "I did not imagine that individual people would ultimately end up with so much of the risk. This is particularly relevant for countries like the United States and Britain, which show up as very major losers. That is where I think the losses really get spread around society. The new study published in the journal Nature Climate Change said the rate of change needed to tackle the climate crisis was so large that the rapid collapse of fossil fuel industries presents major transition risks. The researchers compared a scenario in which little was done to limit global heating and temperatures rose by 3.5 degrees Celsius with a scenario in which substantial action was taken and the global temperature rise was limited to just 2 degrees Celsius. In the second scenario, oil and gas projects valued today at $1.4 trillion cannot continue production and lose their value. The team traced this loss from 43,439 oil and gas production assets through a network of 1.8 million companies to their ultimate owners. They concluded most of the market risk falls on private investors, overwhelmingly in OECD countries, including substantial exposure through pension funds and financial markets. The countries hit hardest by losses in the financial sector would be the United States of America, with $283 billion at risk, and Britain, with $98 billion at risk, both far above the third-place nation, the tax haven of the British Virgin Islands, with $28 billion at risk. Canada and Australia are in the top six. About 90% of the risk in Britain is due to ownership of oil and gas assets in other parts of the world. Companies in West Asia do not have such high losses in the 2 degrees Celsius scenario because some oil and gas will continue to be used and they are the cheapest suppliers. Dr. Gregor Semenyuk from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst said the $681 billion of potentially worthless oil and gas assets on the balance sheets of financial institutions was large compared with the subprime housing assets that led to the 2007-2008 financial crash. He said, "One can compare these numbers in the sense that there is a bunch of mispriced assets floating around if we believe in climate change mitigation." He added, "This number is quite worrying. If the transition to a net zero emission world isn't prudently managed, it raises the risk of financial instability." Mike Coffin, the financial think tank Carbon Tracker Initiative, said the new analysis was complementary to the Carbon Tracker Initiative's own research, which recently found oil companies were at risk of wasting $500 billion on future projects. Mike Coffin said the study focused on future losses from existing assets, adding, "What is critical is that investors recognize the risk of committing huge amounts of capital in new assets that run the risk of becoming stranded as long-term fossil fuel demand weakens." The Guardian recently worked with the Carbon Tracker Initiative to show the 12 biggest oil companies are on track to spend $103 million a day to 2030, on projects that would mean attempts to keep global heating well below 2 degrees Celsius would fail. Mike Coffin said the study also focused on exploration and production, but including other parts of the oil and gas industry, such as refineries and equipment suppliers, would increase potential losses. He added, "The overall magnitude of the stranded asset risk within the oil and gas industry is likely to be significantly larger than that quantified in the study." According to another research, about half of the world's fossil fuel assets will be worthless by 2036 under a net zero transition. Countries that are slow to decarbonize will suffer, but early movers will profit. The study finds that renewable energies and freed up investment will more than make up for the losses to the global economy. It highlights the risk of producing far more oil and gas than required for future demand, which is estimated to leave $11 to $14 trillion in so-called stranded assets, infrastructure, property and investments where the value has fallen so steeply they must be written off. The lead author of the new study, Jean-François Mercure of the University of Exeter in England, said the shift to clean energy would benefit the world economy overall, but it would need to be handled carefully to prevent regional pockets of misery and possible global instability, warning oil capitals such as Houston, Texas, could suffer the same fate as Detroit, Michigan, after the decline of the U.S. car industry unless the transition is carefully managed, he said. In a worst-case scenario, people will keep investing in fossil fuels until suddenly the demand they expected does not materialize, and they realize that what they own is worthless. Then we could see a financial crisis on the scale of 2008. The new paper published in Nature Energy illustrates how a drop in demand for oil and gas before 2036 will reshape the geopolitical landscape. Current investment flows and government commitments to reach net zero emissions by 2050 will make renewable energy more efficient, cheaper and stable, while fossil fuels will be hit by more price volatility. Many carbon assets such as oil or coal reserves will be left unburnt, while machinery will also be stranded and no longer produce value for its owners. The most vulnerable assets are those in remote regions or technically challenging environments. Most exposed are Canadian tar sands, US shale, and the Russian Arctic, followed by deep offshore wells in Brazil and elsewhere. North Sea oil is also relatively expensive to extract and likely to be hit when demand falls. By contrast, current oil, gas and coal importers such as the European Union, Japan, India and South Korea will reap hefty economic dividends from the transition because they will be able to use the money they saved on overseas fuel purchases to invest in their own countries, including money for renewable energies that will modernize infrastructure, create jobs and improve energy independence. The situation for the world's biggest emitters, such as the United States, is more complex, as they have more diversified economies with both substantial fossil fuel assets and powerful renewable energy sectors. Britain is in a similar situation to the United States.
Depression is a mood disorder that causes a persistent feeling of sadness and loss of interest. It affects how you feel, think, and behave, and can lead to a variety of emotional and physical problems. Patients may have trouble doing normal day-to-day activities and could sometimes even feel as if life isn't worth living. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Depression may require long-term treatment with a host of pills, antidepressants, anxiolytics, neuroleptics, and tranquilizers, but sometimes the cure could be much worse than the ailment. Thousands of documented cases prove that the prescription of such drugs have led to suicide, acts of violence, and even murder. Death by prescription reveals the shocking truth about psychotropic drugs and a healthcare system that perhaps undermines the potential dangers of such medication. Stay with us for this part of the documentary.
Mark was 48 years old when he committed suicide in October 2013. He was suffering from recurring back pain and had had an operation, but the cure was worse than the ailment. It hit him hard, and he was prescribed antidepressants. Mark was the father of two children and had never had suicidal thoughts before, but in less than a week, the medication sent him into madness. His sister Florence has still not recovered from it. Is an antidepressant responsible for the death of Florence's brother? These heartbreaking events are echoed in thousands of documented cases across the world. Psychotropic drugs are under the spotlight. Antidepressants, anxiolytics, neuroleptics, sleeping pills, and tranquilizers are supposed to stitch together the fragilities of the soul. They save many lives. But can they also lead to suicide or even murder? What are these psychotropic medications that are sometimes held responsible for acts of violence? First off are antidepressants, the grandfather of the new wave being Prozac. This antidepressant is supposed to act upon depressive states, deep sadness, psychic fatigue, and anxiety. It should give a mood boost in order to bring the patient back to a stable condition. In France, it's taken by at least 6 million people. Next, we have the benzodiazepines, with the most widespread examples being anxiolytic drugs such as Valium or Xanax, but also a high number of sleeping pills. They treat states of anxiety, panic attacks, and insomnia. Unlike antidepressants, they bring the mood down to calm the anxiety. It's a bestseller in France. 11.5 million people take it each year, more than one in four adults. Finally, there are various tranquilizers and powerful neuroleptics, which influence the nerves. Nobody disagrees with how useful these medications are, as they act upon serotonin, a neurotransmitter that regulates the mood. But depending on individuals, they can short-circuit the brain, which can be dangerous and even fatal. In France, Professor Evan is one of the only doctors to sound the alarm. He has compiled or translated a handful of reports and studies that warn against psychotropic drugs. At what moment do these medications become dangerous? For benzodiazepines, whose effects are immediate, it's during the first days of the treatment, especially when coming off the medication. For a large number of people, anxiolytics or sleeping pills can be more addictive than heroin, which is why the treatment shouldn't last longer than a few weeks. As for antidepressants, which don't take effect until 2 or 3 weeks of use, murder or suicide can occur during the first few days of treatment, whenever the dosage is increased, or when the medications are stopped. When this happens, a devastating rebound effect can occur that places some patients in a state that they feel compelled to continue. Before taking his life, Florence's brother was right at the beginning of his treatment. In his letter, he speaks of having acid in his body. Are prescriptions given too readily in France? To allow us to find out, we went to 6 randomly chosen medical clinics equipped with a hidden camera. 95% of psychotropic medication is supplied by general practitioners. Our scenario will be simple, going through a rough patch due to losing a job. 5 minutes and 32 seconds was all it took to get a prescription of anxiolytics during the first consultation. The second doctor hands over a prescription of antidepressants, which he confirms have virtually no side effects whatsoever. The third is not strictly in favor of psychotropic medication, but strangely, he still supplies Seroplex, an antidepressant. Only the fourth finds it too early to give a psychotropic medication in such a case. Antihistamines are also used to treat allergies, but they can facilitate sleep. The fifth proposes an anxiolytic. She suggests a half tablet, then a whole, then two, then up to four a day. The prescription lasts 3 months, whereas the recommended limit is 8 weeks due to the extremely addictive effects of Xanax. If that isn't enough, she suggests adding an antidepressant. But the record was beaten by the last doctor, who proposed both an anxiolytic and an antidepressant in only 2 minutes. Everybody's happy. Except when psychotropic medication drives somebody mad. Here's a brilliant young girl, Aurélie. 6 years ago, her treatment transformed her into a destructive machine. Aurélie could have died or gone insane. She attempted suicide and was then committed to a psychiatric hospital. 6 years ago, with a master's degree in economics, she found a job in New York. She worked hard, went out often, and was close to burnout. She returned to Paris. Her general practitioner was absent, so she met with a psychiatrist. The peaceful young girl was in a rage, and it worried her. So she consulted other doctors. Aurélie had a strong reaction to the dosage increase. A suicide attempt, followed by a psychiatric hospital. She therefore decides to stop the treatment. The violent urges disappeared immediately, but it would take her 2 years to fully recover. Today, Aurélie has rebuilt her life. She lives in London, where she has become a painter. But she still wants to know what really happened. She therefore meets with a reputed British psychiatrist, David Healy. For the pharmaceutical industry, this man is a menace. For years, he has denounced psychotropic medication as dangerous, and his expertise has led to major criticism for the leading laboratories. He claims that these pills are useful, but dangerous.
Well, first of all, the pills can be helpful. I use these pills to treat people, but they don't suit everyone. And when they don't suit you, they can definitely be poisonous. They can make you want to kill yourself. They can make you want to kill other people. And they can generally cause you to hear voices and become crazy. There's certainly about one in 20 people who go on the pills, at least, have what you could call an extreme reaction to them. So that's actually fairly common, okay? Roughly half of the people that go on these pills, they just aren't suited to them. They have a bad reaction, but they don't have an extreme reaction.
If someone has a side effect of the medication, they can say, listen, it's because you had a depression at the beginning, that's why you were like this. So they make you feel that it's because of your first state that you feel so bad. It's not because of the medication.
And this is the problem. This is where things really go wrong, where once you've been put on the pills, doctors don't recognize when they have made things worse. What they say is it's down to doctors. We make the pills, it's down to doctors to use them wisely. If things go wrong, it's the doctor's fault, okay, not ours. Now, the pharmaceutical industry have as much control of the situation as the Soviet Union used to have during the 1960s.
Aurélie comes out of the interview with the impression that she was the victim of a medical error. She thinks about her psychiatrist with a heavy heart. So she will meet up with her 6 years later to finally turn the page. The psychiatrist concedes an error in the diagnosis, but the whole system leads to an increase of psychotropic consumption. It's in the interest of pharmaceutical companies to have a high number of ill people, as psychotropic medication represents a global market of tens of billions of dollars. As the number one user in the world of such medication, France is a true cash register. These happiness pills are making the pharmaceutical companies smile. Their profits exceed those of the petroleum companies. In the United States, this exaggerated medicalization has a particular resonance. As the years went by, unexplained suicides by children taking antidepressants or anxiolytics hit the public opinion. Here, a 10-year-old child is phoning the emergency services. His 14-year-old sister has attempted suicide, having been on Paxil for just a few days, an antidepressant known in France under the name of Seroxat.
This is 911. Who is this? Where is your sister? What is she trying to do? Take pills?
What? No, my dad's home now. Hold on, tell me!
GSK, the laboratory that manufactures Paxil, managed to conceal explosive studies conducted by its own experts. Following a court trial, the authorities obliged GSK to reveal the studies. They showed that the medication increased suicidal thoughts or acts by up to 8 times. Massacres perpetrated by teenagers should also be mentioned. 9 out of 10 killers were on a cocktail of psychotropic medication. Despite thousands of people that call for action against the pharmaceutical companies, Psychotropic medication remains a bestseller in the U.S., and it's business as usual. Every year, the powerful American Psychiatric Association organizes the most important symposium on the planet. Over 5 days, 15,000 psychiatrists from across the globe attend several conferences. The pharmaceutical industry struck gold. It largely finances the event by promoting its latest medications, and the stands invade an entire hall. For the occasion, even the Vice President of the USA, Joe Biden, is here. This reflects the importance of the event. Leading the American Psychiatric Association is Jeffrey Lieberman, certainly the most influential psychiatrist on the planet. During the press conference, we asked him questions regarding the dangers of psychotropic medication.
These are not dangerous drugs by and large, or certainly no more dangerous than those which are used routinely for other non-psychiatric types of disorders. The side effects should never be a deterrent for somebody who genuinely suffers from depression getting treatment.
This is a disease, a brain disorder, with about a 5% mortality rate. Depression is a disorder where you cannot experience emotion because you feel dead inside. You feel hopeless, helpless, and you would be dead, but you probably don't have the wherewithal to figure out how to commit suicide.
A lot of the over-exaggeration about fears of side effects and are promulgated by people who either don't know or don't want to know, and they foment this.
Is Jeffrey Lieberman best positioned to answer about this medication? The list of pharmaceutical companies that finance him is infinite. We can better understand why Jeffrey Lieberman doesn't much like party poopers, the hundreds of protesters who regularly come to disturb the great gathering of psychiatry. This includes a multitude of associations, as well as the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, which is run by Scientologists. Today's slogan, "Stop drugging our soldiers." A wave of unexpected suicides effectively shook the U.S. Army. And the protesters blame the antidepressants that are administered in 9 out of 10 cases.
22 U.S. veterans are committing suicide every single day. There are more active duty military dying from suicide in 2012 than on the battlefield. There are 49 international drug regulatory warnings on antidepressants that caution against aggression, mania, suicide, in some cases homicidal ideation. It's outrageous. So it's not as if the psychiatrists don't know.
Faced with the protesters, the mainly foreign psychiatrists are somewhat skeptical.
What I just discussed a little with them was that there seems to be sometimes it's different, difficult to know if there's a causative relationship. If you have a progression in the disease and you are medicated too, is it the medication or is it the disease itself?
I read stories that quite a few veterans committed suicide last year, but I was wondering how many suicides have been prevented by taking antidepressants. So I suppose you can't cure everything with just taking a pill. You should give the psychotherapy as well, but I'm not sure if the antidepressants are only responsible for the increased suicide rate.
In the Congress room, many conferences take place one after another, but nobody is dealing with the dangers of antidepressants. One of them is led by Anthony Rothschild, a psychiatrist well known for his successful books on psychotropic drugs. The great specialist is holding a debate on the adaptation of treatments depending on the illness. But not once does he say that antidepressants should not be prescribed. Our question is straightforward.
It seems that there is a lot of danger with antidepressants. What do you think about this? Like suicide or, murders?
No. I mean, I don't know what you're talking about, but I just told you there's no reliable scientific evidence that antidepressants cause people to commit murder or any other crime or suicide.
So how come that on boxes?
All right, this is not serious, okay?
Is this a surprising reaction? Anthony Rothschild also has conflicts of interest with an impressive number of pharmaceutical companies.
So I told you what I thought. You're going to keep asking me the same question. Okay, well, you got my quote, all right?
Okay, very good.
How can such things still be said in this day and age when on all the stands promoting psychotropic medication, whole boards are covered by signs warning of side effects? Among the several side effects, the risk of suicide or violent behavior is prioritized by all. These warnings are a legal obligation enforced by medical organizations. But how much are these warnings worth next to the publicity hype from the pharmaceutical companies?
When you're depressed, where do you want to go? Nowhere. Who do you feel like seeing? No one. Depression hurts in so many ways.
Sadness. These ads banned in France reach tens of millions of households in the United States, one of the rare countries where the promotion of medication is allowed.
That treats many symptoms of depression.
For the promoters of these ads, a new customer is a captive customer.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Deep insight and firm determination, the most outstanding qualities of Hazrat Hamza. On January 25, 2022, Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, met with the officials of Hazrat Hamza International Conference. This is a part of his speech with the managers of this conference. In my opinion, there are two important qualities that constituted his personality. One is his firm determination and another is his insight. We must promote these qualities as much as we can. One is firm determination. Sometimes we believe in something but do not act on it because of our weak willpower. Having a firm willpower plays a decisive role. Hazrat Hamza became a Muslim in the 8th year of the Holy Prophet's Ba'tha. Those days were the hardest days for the Holy Prophet because Islam had just become announced publicly and the Holy Prophet and his companions were being attacked from all sides. The hardships that we have heard of are related to those years. During those very difficult circumstances for Muslims, that personality shouted in Masjid al-Haram, next to Kaaba, that he had become a Muslim and that he had believed in the Holy Prophet's religion. Such was his courage, his firm determination, and his insight.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Gaining a correct understanding of things is very important. We should teach ourselves and our people to think carefully on various matters and to make a correct decision. Had we but listened or used our intelligence, we should not now be among the companions of the blazing fire. They will then confess their sins. Chapter 67, verses 10 to 11. If we do not listen and think carefully, this is a sin. The Holy Quran says this clearly. According to the Commander of the Faithful, as quoted by Imam Baqir alayhi salam, peace and greetings be upon him, Hazrat Hamza was a manifestation of among the believers of men who have been true to their covenant with God. How does being true to their covenant with God take place? The full and complete form of it is to become a role model for divine teachings and divine commands and stepping forward for the path that God has specified. That is, such personalities become a manifestation of these qualities. We should learn this.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Afghanistan has concluded his 11-day trip to the country. Holding a press conference in Kabul, Richard Bennett expressed concern about the violation of human rights in Afghanistan, calling on the Taliban to abide by their promises.
Afghanistan is facing a plethora of critical human rights challenges that are having a severe impact on the population. I urge the authorities to acknowledge the human rights challenges that they are facing and to close the gap between their words and their deeds.
Mr. Bennett also called for investigation into blind terror attacks in the country, saying systematic attacks on Shia Hazaras involve marks of crimes against humanity.
I call for investigations into a series of attacks on places of worship and schools in Kabul, Kunduz, and Balkh provinces, instances of which have been claimed by the ISISK group. In particular, such attacks specifically targeting members of the Hazara, Shia, and Sufi communities are becoming increasingly systematic in nature and reflect elements of an organizational policy, thus bearing the hallmarks of crimes against humanity.
The UN expert also urged the international community to continue relief funds to Afghanistan, saying sanctions on the Taliban should not harm the Afghan people.
The humanitarian and economic crisis is very concerning, and I call on the international community to continue to provide humanitarian support and to ensure that the implementation of applicable sanctions do not substantially impede the provision of essential public services accessible to all, which are necessary for the enjoyment of human rights.
The independent expert advised the Taliban to form an inclusive government and establish fair engagement with the people if they want to end instability and suffering on Afghan soil. The UN expert's trip to Afghanistan comes as the country has been facing rights violations in different aspects. Afghan people hope their rights are protected and the international community closely watches developments in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.